I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. One of the first NATO nation acts against the greatest journalist of our times, Julian Assange, was not to assassinate him, but to use PayPal on the internet to prevent People Power organizing to donate funds to WikiLeaks before the British tortured him. Control of money is a determinant feature of imperial hegemony, and now from Palestine to Venezuela to Iran, Korea, Russia and China, NATO nations use money sanctions to impose geopolitical will. But with the growth of so-called cashless society, crypto and fintech, is it the end of neocon hegemonic power of money, its KYC and SWIFT banking systems that can easily be bypassed? And what about how this is happening while actually in NATO countries, fintech and its PR is used to impose totalitarian control over populations? Brett Scott is the author of Cloud Money, Cash Cards, Crypto and the War for Our Wallet and the Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, Hacking the Future of Money. He joins me now from Berlin, Germany. Thank you so much, Brett, for coming on. Before we start talking about fiat money, gold, your view on crypto, given that its use is very diverse, it's been very volatile, and it's meant in the past year or so, NATO nations don't seem to be able to sanction those they wish to sanction labor, because crypto, Bitcoin, bypasses Washington.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, crypto has a kind of used as a sort of, I guess, a kind of like a sideshow to the global monetary system. I think when I'm thinking about Bitcoin and stuff like that, I see it as a kind of system of digital collectibles that can be moved around. And sure, if you're in a place that's being sanctioned, you can use those digital collectibles to bypass the banking sector and so on. But they're highly volatile, right? So it's not an ideal alternative to the existing monetary system, but they do form a kind of partial counterpower to the existing monetary system, just not a very good one.
And of course, national security agencies could be causing the volatility, as some people suspect. But interestingly, you said that in NATO countries, I suppose is what you meant, crypto is malign in the way that it teaches children bad things about what money is.
Yeah, well, I mean, bear in mind, there's kind of like a reality to what Bitcoin is and then a fantasy, right? So the reality is quite simple. The reality of Bitcoin is actually that they're, as I described them, as digital collectibles, sort of limited edition digital objects that can be moved around, right? And that's fine. They have prices. They get priced on a market, right? The fantasy is that they're a competing monetary system to the US dollar, okay? And in order for the promoters of those objects to convince people that these are a alternative to the US dollar, they have to resort to a lot of conservative monetary ideology, right? So they have to present these things as being digital gold and all this kind of stuff. And that often results in them drawing on lots of tropes of austerity, essentially, right? The idea that money should be a constrained thing, right? It shouldn't, it should be like a commodity. And that's very much what Margaret Thatcher and people like that used to use when they were saying, oh, we can't afford things. Money is a constrained commodity. So we're going to cut, privatize everything and stop spending on healthcare and stop spending on education, right? Because we can't find money. Right. So this whole idea that money is a constrained commodity is a very classic part of austerity thinking. And if you're thinking about how you train a teenager to think like that, Bitcoin's a very good way to do that. Right. And the great thing about that is that it simultaneously doesn't actually challenge the existing monetary system. All right. So you might want to think about it as being like a kind of it rides on top of the existing monetary system rather than bypassing it. Okay, so the net effect actually of promoting the ideology is that the conservatives of the normal monetary system, the fiat money system, get more powerful because their message is being promoted via Bitcoin. I don't know if that made full sense.
I mean, that, and of course, your background as an anthropologist and a financial broker who nearly ended up at Lehman Brothers just ahead of the crash. Clearly evident there in what you're saying there. And I think you've written about gold, this myth of how gold is taught in schools, within the media, how journalists use it as the heyday of money, when it wasn't the neoliberal model of money. You smash that to pieces.
Well, look, I'm not like a economic historian that specializes in talking about every era of the monetary system, right? There's a lot of nuance and stuff. You can spend hours talking about the thing. But the most important thing to realize is that in the modern imagination, right, a lot of conservatives will fixate upon an imagined history of gold, right? And the political use of that is to create the idea that what money should be is, again, as I mentioned, that Thatcherite idea, that it should be a constrained commodity that's in the hands of creditors, essentially, right? And that you shouldn't dilute their power, all right? So the whole kind of story about gold being the past of money has a very strong conservative lineage. In reality, there are elements of gold used in the past. Of course, you would have certain types of gold systems, but they never operated in the way that a lot of conservative economists would claim that they operated. For example, a lot of nation states would actually define the value of gold. It wasn't sort of self-apparent to everybody. And furthermore, most everyday commerce wasn't done with gold, right? It was done with credit systems. So the main point to sort of take away is that the kind of the imagination of gold as the sort of almost like Platonic ideal of money is very problematic, right? And this is not to say that it wasn't historically used for certain things, right?
So not that different to forged interbank lending rates in London, the control of gold.
It's huge political control of the gold system in the past. It never was this imagined sort of pure commodity money like people want to imagine. And bear in mind, in that Bitcoin world, they're drawing on that imagined history of gold to say, in the past, money was pure. Then it became corrupted. Now we've made it pure again in this digital form. It's a very kind of puritanical way of thinking about money, and it's also historically inaccurate.
Well, let's just get to a definition then of money. I should just say personally, you know, when I was first at the BBC in London, I got into loads of trouble. I was the only person on night shift when Barings Banks went bust in the City of London, and I chose casino B-roll pictures to illustrate voiceovers. And right from the top of the BBC, they said, never use roulette tables ever again when talking about finance. You, however, use the analogy when defining money. What is money?
Well, at a very meta level, if you're looking for the most kind of generic description, I would tend to say, money is a system of network access tokens that enable us to access a network of human labor, right? That's a very broad way of speaking about it. And if you think about it, a lot of traditional ways of describing money, people imagine that there is some like value stored in money. They'll talk about it as being a store of value, as if somehow the object carries something, a bit like, you know, blood or something, right? The reality is that all value in an economic system is stored in human beings and natural systems, right? That's where everything comes from. The monetary system is embedded into that, a bit like a nervous system, perhaps, if you want to use a biological metaphor. But the units of money essentially are portioning claims upon our labor, right? So when you're holding money, you're holding claims upon other people. This is why I'm saying it's like a network access token. It's an access token that enables you to access people. That is a very generic description, though. There's a lot more technical detail about how monetary systems are actually constructed, all right? So the construction of monetary systems takes multiple different forms. Right now, the way that the monetary system is constructed is in layers, all right, hierarchical layers. Using credit instruments. And at the core of that is the central bank, but the commercial banking sector right now issues lots of the money that we use as well. I can go into the different layers if you'd like me to.
But the network access token has similarities to casino chips. I know that in NATO countries, the ATM machines seem to be being reduced in lots of inner city areas. Just explain how the ATM works within the analogy of cashing in the chips.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, when you look at the construction of a modern monetary system, it has about at least three layers, right? So the base layer that you would, economists would call base money, I just call like layer one money, is from central banks, right? And those are pushed out and also sucked back in, right? So you push them out when states are spending and sucked back in when there's taxation occurring, right? In the public, that's the cash system, right? So the only form of, if you want to call it layer one money that we can access, or state money, is cash, right? Then there's a second layer built on top of that, which is the banking sector, right? And the metaphor you want to think about, if you understand that, is I use a casino as a metaphor to help people to grasp that. So if you walk into a casino and you take cash and you hand it over to a casino cashier, they're going to push out chips to you, right? And those chips are a secondary form of money, privately issued, right? That's connected back to the cash. And you, at the end of the night, the casino can go back and reclaim the cash and walk out. So in the banking sector, how this metaphor works, if you want to think about it, when you're handing over cash to a bank, they're not storing the cash for you. They're taking ownership of it from you, and then they push out digital casino chips to you. So those units that you see in your bank account, or if you're looking on your online account on your phone, those units are digital casino chips issued out by the banking sector. And what's called the cashless society is when you basically become totally dependent upon those digital casino chips, all right? And when you're closing down ATMs, right, in these countries, and a lot of countries in Europe, for example, especially in the UK, all the kind of branches and ATMs are being shut down. It's a bit like shutting down the ability to exit the system, to cash out of the system, all right? So it's like going back to the at the end of a night in the casino and saying, hey, I want to convert my chips back to cash, and them saying, sorry, we don't do that anymore. You're now captured in our system, right? You cannot exit our system. One of the main problems with that metaphor, though, of the casino is that, you know, just to nuance it a bit, is that in a normal casino, every unit of cash is connected to a chip, but in our banking sector, the banking sector has the ability to issue far more digital casino chips than they have in cash reserves, and that's what's sometimes called fractional reserve banking.
Is that what's debated at Basel? These strange accords in Switzerland, where they organize how much the ratios are.
Yeah, so exactly. That's basically
just explain that.
Yeah, those are the different ratios. The technical ratios in banking are basically about how you manage the risk that emerges from that process, right? So the banking sector is pushing out huge amounts of these digital casino chips, and in return, they're harvesting loan assets, right? So they're not pushing them out for nothing. They push them out in different circumstances. So, for example, if you turn up at a bank and you say, "Here's some cash, I'm depositing it," they're taking that from you and giving you chips. But you could also be a person who's borrowing money. You turn up at a bank and say, "Can I borrow some money?" And they'll just push out new chips to you, right? But what they're dragging back from you in return is a loan asset, right? So what's happening is banks will construct these balance sheets where they're pushing out these digital chips, which are actually a liability to them, but they're extracting back assets in return, and that puts them in certain types of risk. So those capital adequacy ratios and things in Basel, what they debate, or basically about how do you manage the risk of this process.
Brett Scott, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Cloud Money, Why the War on Cash Endangers Our Freedom, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Brett Scott, author of Cloud Money, Why the War on Cash Endangers Our Freedom. Brett, we were talking about those ratios, which they don't really talk about in the financial press that much, about the leverage levels that eventually get bailed out, actually, as they did after 2008. In fact, maybe you want to personally just mention how when you were at university, they managed to recruit the so-called brightest and best into these industries. And actually, many of them may go into the media, too, to spread the word that cashless society, fintech, these great new changes are important, and if you don't believe in them, you are a Luddite.
Yeah, sure. When I was at university, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and, you know, Merrill Lynch, all of those big players would sort of hover around the elite universities and try to recruit and essentially harvest all the graduates, or at least create the idea that what success meant was being part of the professional services industry. And that was around I was in the financial sector around the time of the financial crisis. Interestingly, since the financial crisis, what happened around that time was actually big tech started to get more sexy, right? So actually the idea of what was something to aspire to started to shift. And actually over the years, since the financial crisis, a lot of those graduates started to get attracted to the big tech companies or to the fintech companies. And the fintech sector is actually the sort of realm where big tech meets big finance, right? Where the automation of big finance. But in the early years, post the financial crisis of 2008, the fintech industry kind of looked a little bit like it was a kind of revolutionary democratization of finance, which is a very sort of typical tech narrative. When they automate things, they talk about it as being a revolution or something that's going to democratize stuff. So the fintech sector had that narrative. So the situation right now is that actually big tech has become more powerful than big finance, but they certainly are joining together in various ways, right, via these fintech infrastructures. And part of that, part of how that's manifesting in our society right now, for example, is an attack on the cash system, right? Because bear in mind, cash is a form of money that's very hard to automate. A lot of human beings really love the cash system and find it very useful, but big companies do not like the cash system because they can't automate it, right? And so, you know, in the case of big tech companies like Amazon, they will literally cannot operate with cash. But even, you know, big supermarkets, you know, and these big retailers and stuff, they actually would prefer to work with the big tech companies and to deal with ordinary human beings dealing with physical money, right? So the automation drive is part of corporate capitalism more generally, and it's manifesting in our society as a sort of ideological attack on the cash system. And they'll tell you that if you still want to use cash, you're somehow stuck in the past, there's something wrong with you, you don't believe in progress, which is another way of saying you don't believe in corporate automation of our society.
Is it different, though, in Global South countries where the development is not at the stage of late capitalism? They're catching up to a stage where they might be able to democratize. We spoke to former Ecuadorian central banker, Dr. Andrea Arauz, who said clearly digital national bank currencies would be important and give people ideas of stakes in their societies rather than private banking.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you look where power in the global system lies, right, it lies in the US and Europe, and there's a few in China, right? So the actual narrative is set there, okay? And in many Global South countries, when you have leaders who have bought or sort of swallowed the Kool-Aid, as it were, they'll often actually parrot that same ideology, even though in Global South countries, often people actually, you know, for example, I'm from South Africa. In South Africa, the electrical infrastructure is down for 4 hours a day sometimes, 6 hours a day, right? The idea that you're going to digitize everything is a fantasy, right? Actually, in a country like South Africa, you're interested in resilience, right? So things like cash are actually really useful. But still, the ideology that comes from Silicon Valley will permeate through the continent, right? Now, in certain
couldn't
places—
couldn't it be harnessed in a different way? It could be harnessed in South Africa differently too.
Yeah, so for example, in the African context, you'll have talks about digital sovereignty, right? You'll have local intellectuals, local politicians who will debate whether it's possible to detach from the main international system and to actually forge some form of autonomy, to say, okay, we don't be totally reliant upon Visa and MasterCard. So you mentioned Andres Arauz from Ecuador, right? He's a friend of mine. Andres saw that basically the global digital payment systems are controlled essentially by Visa, MasterCard, the SWIFT network, the US banks, Federal Reserve. They're at the sort of apex of that system. And if you're a country like Ecuador, you basically have no rights within that system. So if you're a US citizen, you can maybe demand some rights in the sort of Visa and MasterCard system. You can say, well, I don't want to be spied upon. But if you're an Ecuadorian citizen, you don't get those rights. So in that context, that call for digital sovereignty becomes very important, because you could say, well, actually, we can maybe form some parallel system, all right? It's a very hard thing to do, but that's why, for example, Andres will promote the idea of a central bank digital currency in a place like Ecuador, all right? But yeah, in the, when you zoom out and look at the overall system, the power lies with the big US firms, and at least in the sort of Western world and in the Chinese firms, right?
But when we, I know we were talking about cashless society and the myth of convenience and the PR spin to persuade us. But on digital central bank currencies then, do they offer more national sovereignty over the economy for any democratically elected government because they're outside and could be outside of the Washington consensus?
Hypothetically, yeah, I mean, it really depends on how they're implemented. I mean, even actually in, you know, European countries and stuff, there's potential for CBDCs to have the ability to counter the power of the banking sector. Remember that sort of image I painted of the monetary system having multiple players and kind of, you know, there's a sort of central bank, but then there's all the commercial banks. And what you call the cashless society is really when those commercial banks take over and you have to use their kind of digital casino chips for all your payments. Now, many years ago, actually, monetary reform groups started saying the commercial banking sector is too powerful, right? So we need to actually have a new form of digital state money to compete with it. So hypothetically, if a central bank started issuing a new type of digital money, it would offer you an alternative to having a bank account. So, and this could even in countries like the UK, for example, imagine if the Bank of England started saying, we're going to offer an account that you could use, and that's going to compete with players like Barclays and HSBC, right? And that's what actually a central bank digital currency hypothetically could be if it
isn't,
was done.
Isn't
in
that
a
where the WTO
fashion.
Steps in, or
the reality
some international
is,
body saying this is against privatization and therefore anti-neoliberal.
So the radical version of CBDC is definitely not popular among mainstream elites, right? But that was a potential way of doing it in the past, this idea that you could actually have this almost like a public infrastructure around digital payments that would compete with the private one. The reason why things like central bank digital currency are being discussed right now, though, is not because of that radical vision. The reason is that during the pandemic, there was a massive drop in cash usage as everyone was forced online, and central bankers suddenly realized that there's a potential financial stability problem that emerges when the cash system goes down, right? Now, that's a whole kind of structural problem in the monetary system. So they said, maybe we need to sort of think about creating some kind of alternative to cash in digital form. But because the central bankers don't want to harm the banking sector and don't want to compete with it too much, they're watering down all their CBDC proposals to say, if we do this, we'll get the private banks to kind of run it for us and it won't disturb them. But basically, so there's multiple versions of the CBDC design that you could have. But the current versions being proposed in the, you know, your sort of European countries are not very radical. But hypothetically, in a global South country, you could implement a CBDC as some way to create a local digital infrastructure. Because bear in mind, even in a global South country, your local banks are often going to be siding with Visa and MasterCard, right? Because they're going to be wanting to get into the international system. So sometimes your local banks are working against your digital sovereignty, as it were.
Central bank digital currency. Well, just finally, it's a year of elections. How do you think the powers that be, these elites, manage to persuade electorates all around the world who'll be voting this year that the grocery shop analogy of how an economy works is the way an economy works? They seem to manage to be able to say there isn't enough money to pay for this. They will offer this in their manifesto, given that you're explaining something even more complicated about the future of money.
Are you asking me how they will justify
the grocery shop? I mean, this grocery shop myth, there isn't enough money. Does that make any sense to you?
Sure. I suppose the traditional way they try to present themselves as being like a household, that's a very classic Thatcherite idea that the government is like a household like any other, and it has limitations on its budget, all right? Which is not true. I mean, one of the ways to think about this is to imagine like, I don't know if this metaphor fully works, but like an oak tree versus squirrels, right? So squirrels run around trying to get the acorns, but the oak tree wants the squirrels to take its acorns. right? And this is very much like the state and the monetary system. We imagine ourselves as squirrels, you know, trying to get the money, trying to work hard to find the money. But actually, the state issues money. It's like an oak tree. So when it's engaged in this kind of masquerade that it's like a giant squirrel, it also has like a limits to how many nuts it has. That's a kind of fantasy. It's a political fantasy, and it's also a very useful political fantasy for certain types of people who want to, you know, privatize stuff or gut public services, right? So there's a huge politics to speaking about money as if it is some kind of, you know, limited supply of nuts. And that's classic austerity politics, right? So, I don't know how politicians will do it this coming year, but it's always a massive part of electoral politics. There's also the big element of it as well that comes into it, and this is them scaremongering about inflation, right? To say, if we try to employ too many people, there'll be inflation. So we got to keep a bunch of people unemployed to keep that down. I don't know if this fully answers your question, but it's a big question.
Anthropologist, economist, zoologist, clearly. Brett Scott, thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot.
That's it for the show. Remember, we're bringing you new episodes every Saturday and Monday. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you soon.